Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. This one is a little groundbreaking because I've invited a former guest back to tell more of her spectacular stories. And I'm going to welcome back Erica Elliott for this episode. You might remember her stories before, particularly the one about what happened when she saw that werewolf that one time. Well, I recently had the pleasure of reading Erica's next book, From Mountains to Medicine, Scaling the Heights in Search of My Calling. And I have to tell you, I was reading it and I thought, oh my gosh, how did I not know this about Erica? Oh my gosh, this woman is actually a miracle herself. Among the many stories she tells in this book, which frankly I could not put down, it is so good, is that she has summited so many mountains in the world. I thought, how did I not know this? My favorite is the one where she reaches the top with her team. They all kind of get altitude sickness, they're swollen, they barely make it to base camp. Erica discovers that another two climbers that she knew, they haven't come down yet, they haven't returned, and they're not going to. They're kind of already planning that they're gonna die on the mountain. And Erica says, no, get out of my way, I'll take care of it. She hikes back up the mountain and she rescues these two men. I am just in awe at Erica's bravery, her indomitable quest for adventure, and the way that she just takes life in and engages in life with wholeheartedness. This book, I just could not put it down, so I urge you to get your own copy. In the teaser, you'll hear a little bit of how she wanted to go to med school at Stanford, but she couldn't afford to actually go out there. And so in her true Erica style, she finds a solution and she deals with it and she makes it happen. And I think that speaks volumes to who Erica is. She is unstoppable, she's fierce, and she is here for the adventure. So now here's the very next episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings podcast.
Truthful. I'm not full of artifice. I'm very transparent. So I said, you know, I can't afford it. I don't have any savings. And, it would be very costly because I'd have to, you know, buy some nice outfit and then stay in a hotel and plane fare and everything. Do you think you could come out here and interview me? And then there was no answer. And that's when I talked really fast. I said, I realized, I think I said something wrong. And so I talked really fast, said, well, you know, if you came out here, you know, I'm a former outward bound instructor and I have all this gear and I could teach you how to cross country ski. And I would provide everything, the lunch and the backpacks and the gear, and we could go to Rocky Mountain National Park and ski in there and then have our lunch on a log and with the sun shining down while you interview me, and then silence. My name is Erica Elliott and I'm a physician here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I have a busy practice, but I'm not taking new patients because I have too many patients and they come from all over the country because what I kind of am known for is like, quote, the health detective. In fact, my fourth book is going to be on how I figure out these medical mysteries. I have people who've seen the top specialists in the country. And sometimes in 10 minutes, I can figure out what's wrong with them. And it's not because I'm a genius. It's because I use common sense, believe it or not. And I ask questions and I make a timeline like a real detective. And I consider all sorts of culprits that we never learned in school because I studied environmental medicine afterwards because most of the problems in our modern world relate to environmental medicine, which we never learned about nutrition, about breathing toxins, putting them on our body, eating toxic food, building toxic homes, mold, Lyme disease, all the things that we never learned. These are the people who are desperate to get help. I'm working on my third memoir now. It's a trilogy. The first you read, and in my time with the Navajo people over 50 years ago, and why it's so compelling story is because I'm linguistically oriented, so I actually learn Navajo. It's like impossible language to learn, but somehow I'm wired that way. I'm not wired for some other things, but I am wired for languages. And once I learned Navajo, my life changed completely. The people acted completely different to me. They warmed up to me. They were not the people I thought they were. They're incredibly smart and friendly. And the other white teachers thought they were not very smart, the students, and were very insulting. And I discovered that's not the case at all. And then they welcomed me into their home and their ceremonies. I saw things that white people have never seen and probably never will. I witnessed miracles too, like in the peyote ceremonies, and I couldn't explain it by my science mind. I had to go to another place to try to figure out how these miracles happened. And then this book that you just read is about my 10-year search for finding my calling. I knew since I was a little girl, I knew that I was here for a reason. None of my friends talk like that. And so I kept it quiet to myself because I didn't want to come across as weird. But I look around and I think there must be more to life than this, than just, you know, going to school and then coming home and playing with your friends and doing homework and eating dinner and going to bed. And so I thought there's got to be more than this. In order to find my purpose, I first had to find out who I was. Mm-hmm. I had a huge misconception of who I was. Mm-hmm. And because I had a confusing childhood because we moved around constantly. And in order to be accepted and not bullied or isolated and have friends and everything, I had to learn how to mimic. I had to learn how to mimic their accents or actually learn their language, right, and dress like them. And I did such a good job at it that I didn't know who the real me was. I went to high school in Germany, and we had an American advisor, college advisor, helping us make a decision about where to go to college in the United States. Mm-hmm. And all the colleges seemed the same in the catalog. I didn't really know how to choose. Mm-hmm. But then I met some, while I was hitchhiking around in Europe in the summer, and back in those days, it was safe to do it. So it wasn't like, oh my God, she's such a big risk taker. Everybody, lots of people my age did it. And I'd stay at youth hostels, and every once in a while, I'd run into these groups of people who were really different and stood out because they dressed like gypsies or something, and most of them were musical, and they play together, and I'd listen, and then I want to talk to them because they look so fascinating. And they came from Antioch College. I'd never heard of that before. And they seemed more knowledgeable about politics worldwide than I'd ever imagined anyone could know that much. And here I was living in Europe, and they knew way more about what was going on than I did. And I was very impressed. They seemed really smart, very eccentric. And so I went and read the catalog about the college and found out that it was very progressive. I'm not sure. I didn't know exactly what that meant, being progressive. I thought, well, it means they're ahead of their times, but what does that look like? I didn't know. But it sounded really, really good. Like they were the first white college to take Black students. And Martin Luther King's wife went there. And Horace Mann, who founded it, said, never let a day pass where you haven't helped somebody or made the world a better place. So I thought, oh, that sounds really good. So I told my college counselor that I'd finally picked a place. She wanted me to go. She said, when you don't know where to go, just go to where your parents went. Well, my mother went to the University of Zurich in Switzerland. She's Swiss. And my father did his graduate studies in Harvard, and I didn't want to go there. And so I told her I found a place that I'm going to go. I'm going to apply. And when she heard me say Antioch College, she gasped and said, "That's no place for a nice, smart girl like you. You should try, you know, Radcliffe or Smith and stuff." And so I said, "Why is it not a place for somebody like me?" She thought for a minute, and then she said, "Well, they're constantly protesting the war in Vietnam." And I said, "What's wrong with that?" And she said, "Well, it's against our government. That's terrible." And I said, "Well, is anything else wrong with the school?" "Well, they're the only school in the college in the nation who they have boys and girls in the same dorm." I said, "Well, my brothers and my sisters, we all share the same house and bathroom, and it's not weird." And then I said, "Anything else?" She said, "Yes, they smoke marijuana." I said, "What's that?" It was marijuana. But I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Well, it's a plant that makes you crazy." And I thought, "Well, that's interesting."
Well, I love that part in your book where you're dressed so nicely. You have your mini skirt on, got your purse, you walk up to the college, and there's a naked man right there.
I was so shocked. And also they spoke in a way that I didn't understand, because these were the hippie times and I missed the beginning of that. I was gone. So I was in total shock at the way people dressed, and they used words I'd never heard of before. They'd ask me things like, the driver took me to the college from the airport. He asked me if I had ever dropped acid. I said, "I don't think so. I mean, maybe in chemistry class, maybe a couple of drops." And everything he said, I couldn't understand. He said, "Do you smoke weed?" And I said, "I've never smoked weeds before." So anyway, this group of people were standing around this naked guy, and he was talking like he was preaching, like he was Jesus or something, and he's stark naked. And I tapped this student, this guy, on the shoulder, and I'm very polite, which didn't fit in there either. I said, "Excuse me, sir, could you please tell me what's happening here?" And he said, the dude's flipped out on acid. And I said, "Oh, okay, thank you." I had no idea what that meant. Anyway, so then I sort of had a talk with myself. And I said, "Okay, you've adapted to all these different cultures. You can adapt to this. You can, first of all, get rid of the mini skirt and the heels and the purse." So I walked down to Yellow Springs to a secondhand store, and I bought all the, you know, the embroidered top and the kind of ragged jeans and the huarache sandals from Mexico and a woven bag. And then I said, "Okay, the next step is to, now that I look like them, the next step is to learn how to talk like them and everything." And so then I decided that I was going to try out this new life. And also, by the way, they were so progressive that I couldn't handle it, because you take these tests, and if you score high enough on the tests, you don't have to take those requirements. And of course, I had a great education in Germany, so I tested out of most of my requirements, unfortunately, science and math and stuff. Unfortunate because I had no grounding. I was floating around taking all sorts of things, theater, sculpture, pottery, 19th century French literature.
Stuff. I love that. I love that.
Yeah, but I was too regimented. My father was a general. My mother was old-fashioned Swiss, very harsh, very critical, very, and so here I am thinking, I'm completely wasting my time. But trying to adapt, I tried everything they offered, like junk food. I tried marijuana, which didn't do well for me. I found out years later, genetically, I can't clear THC. So it makes me psychotic. I have very strange perceptions that are not enjoyable, that are terrifying. And then I tried LSD and I tried psilocybin. And pretty soon I was totally psychotic. And I was sleep deprived because my roommate had sex all night with her boyfriend. And I was too embarrassed. I didn't want to sound like a prude and say, could you go someplace else to do this? And so I completely went crazy. And I thought, I've made a huge mistake by coming to this college. And I am completely lost, and I have no purpose in my life. My life is completely meaningless, and I'm completely worthless. And I'm going to do what they did in 19th century French literature when they committed suicide, and it was romanticized like it's a noble thing to do for unrequited love. So I decided I was going to do that too, and so I sat. I opened the oven door and sat there and turned on the gas and nothing happened. I thought, well, this isn't the way it is in the books. So I must be doing something wrong. And then I thought, oh, the pilot light isn't lit. So I got a box of matches and I lit it and the whole place exploded. And I was thrown back in my chair, slammed against the wall. The whole place shook and everything was burned on my face, my hair, my eyebrows, eyelashes were burned off. And
when I read that part in the book, I was just absolutely astonished that you survived. But also, I think it speaks so greatly to kids going out in the world and trying to find their way and needing support and needing love and needing guidance. And it broke my heart when I read that passage in your book, because, I've certainly felt alone like that in my life and completely lost. And I've never done, anything that you did. But after I read that passage, I thought, my God, she's lucky she lived.
I'm lucky I lived. I clearly, there was a spirit in me that not only wanted to live, but really wanted to find, I had to live in order to find my purpose. And so that spirit, I think, was protecting me or something. I don't know. I thought the same thing. How did I ever survive that?
I was just going to say really quickly that I thought it was interesting based on, of course, reading your first book and your second book, that then you had this encounter with the mountain lion, and then you have this experience with this Navajo woman who says to you, hey, and this was a really beautiful thread that you pulled through your book. Hey, this touchstone in your life, your life is going to be challenging. There are going to be ups and downs. There are going to be some dangerous things that happen in your life. And, meanwhile, I'm reading your book, right? And here you're on this mountain. You're on this mountain. Then you save, you're on this crazy climb and you save two men's lives who I just thought to myself, my God, that prophecy that woman, the Navajo woman gave you was 100. And then I was like, was right on. But then later, after you survive, you save those two men's lives, you think, I wonder if this is the dangerous thing that she was talking about. And I thought, what? Oh, my God, of course it was. You've had an extraordinary life.
I know. I can blame it all on my thinking I had a purpose in life as a little girl, because it made me do some strange things. So
yeah, and brave things. Brave things.
Yeah.
I mean, for me as well, when you went to see your uncle and he put you on a 2-week fast, I thought to myself, okay, I would have probably just gotten back on the train and walked away. And then I'm reading your journal entries of day one, day two, day three, day four. And I thought to myself, my God, I don't think I could ever do this. I love that, you know, your uncle is like, this is the way to live and this is how things are. And we're going to do this because you're toxic, because you've been living in America. And you think to yourself, I think I might leave. I might get out of here because this is totally crazy, Vince. But then you stayed and it seems like it changed your whole life.
It did. It changed my whole life, and it planted the first seeds of what I'm supposed to be doing. But the seeds weren't watered for a long time, which is appropriate, which is fine. In fact, it's really good that they weren't watered right away, because I wasn't ready to dive into medicine. I had to go on a long journey to come to right what was in front of my nose the whole time.
Well, reading that whole thing about the fast and the water, and you're drinking water and you're drinking water and you're drinking water. And then he's like, oh, let's go on a walk. Oh, let's go on a hike. Oh, let's go ice skating. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? I would have just been laying in bed crying softly to myself. But then at the end of that 2 weeks, and then I think they said, what did they say? You can have half a banana today.
A black banana, so super overripe, almost like pure sugar.
and then they're like, you can have 3/4 of a banana today. And then it sounds like you're on a raw food diet, which I thought was really fascinating. And I think that probably changed your life as well.
Yeah, it did. It opened me up to experiences I never would have had ever in my life. I don't follow a raw foods diet, but what was hugely eye-opening to me is most people feel horrible when they fast. Well, I did feel horrible the first few days, because you're releasing massive amounts of toxins, so much so that now our world is so much more toxic than it was 50 years ago. So I don't recommend prolonged fasting to anybody, because you could release these toxins so much that it overwhelms your liver and your kidneys and actually harm you. So I wish I had said something in the book about that I don't recommend this. I think I made a mistake by overlooking that, because I don't want people to think, well, I'm going to try that, because in these times, no, it's a bad idea, really bad. Intermittent fasting, that's fine. 1 or 2 days, that's fine. But anyway, but what I was going to say is eventually I felt fantastic. And Uncle Ernst explained to me, because most people they feel horrible the whole time. And I felt like really so clear-headed and everything. And he says, this is proof that your diet is harming you. And I found out later what exactly it was. I was allergic to dairy products and didn't know it. How was I supposed to know it? Because like the saying goes, a fish in water doesn't know they're in water. If you have dairy every day and you never associate that with feeling bad ever. And so,
totally, so that was absolutely
too. And it explained why I had mood swings and all sorts of things. They all disappeared. And so it had so much benefit that that month with my uncle benefited me enormously.
Well, and was also utterly entertaining to read. I mean, I'm just so in awe of your bravery and your tenacity. And, you know, the main gist of this podcast, I always ask everyone, and I'm asking it kind of early now because I know you have a lot of stories, is I would love to hear some stories where you feel like you've experienced miracles or witnessed some of the magic in the world. Because honestly, when I was reading your book and I'm like, oh, there's another one. Oh, there's another magical moment. Oh my goodness, this is so miraculous. I can't believe this. And, you know, for example, your absolutely banana pants climb at the end of the book to the top of that mountain, and just how arduous and stressful. And I mean, the physical endurance you must have. And then at the end, right, after you guys have summited, you've torn the pages out of the book, you leave something, you're coming back down, you know, you're all swollen. Nobody recognizes you. You're kind of on your last legs because you're descending. You're trying to do it safely. This is so dangerous. Then you have to go and rescue two more people. And I thought, oh my gosh, for those two men, Erica was the miracle that day, honestly. And the fact that you can do this kind of stuff, or when you were younger, is just beyond me. And that you were so driven to do it. It seemed like such a passion for you.
I knew the whole time that I was learning important life. So my motive, you know, I was almost always the only woman in the climbing groups, but I noticed a big difference, not in skill or energy or endurance, not that. I noticed a difference in the purpose of why they're climbing and why I'm climbing, and it wasn't the same. That's where we were totally different. Theirs was, and I'm putting, I'm speaking for them. They might disagree with what I'm saying, but it seemed like the summit was everything to them. And for me, the summit was important too, but only in a symbolic way. It's about overcoming demons and fears and limitations. Everything I did on the mountain was a metaphor for me, but it wasn't for these men. At least I don't think so. I didn't get that impression. I didn't get that impression. It probably did serve that, but they weren't aware of it. I was aware of it the whole time. I was aware I was learning really important things that would apply to that grandmother's prophecy, by the way. It drove me because she said that the life that I would face life-threatening challenges, and if I survived, I would have powerful medicine to bring to the people. And I kept thinking, I have to learn all these lessons so I'll survive whatever it is that I have to face. So that drove me too, because, you know, I wanted to learn from these life-threatening challenges so it wouldn't kill me.
Well, I do think it's really interesting. I mean, that for me, in your stories, that prophecy that was given to you, and what I really especially think is powerful, she says, if you survive. So there's no guarantee. There's no guarantee that you're going to make it through this mountain climb or make it through whatever experience you're having. But it's if you survive, you'll have powerful medicine to bring to the people, which, quite honestly, you know, I look at your life and it's, of course, the books and how we learn about you, your life, your experience, how to be inspired, how to keep going despite great odds. But also, now you're literally practicing medicine. Yes. And I mean, that's fascinating in itself. Especially since in the book you say when you were younger, oh my goodness, I'm not smart enough. I can't do this. You know, this isn't my thing. And I just thought that was what a huge hill also to climb, that hill of belief that you're not, that you can't do it.
Yeah. So what happened was when I was with Uncle Ernst, he was the only doctor I'd ever had experience with. I mean, you know, yes, I go into some clinic and get this and that, but no real knowledge about doctors. So he was my only role model. And he was a true genius. No doubt about it. My father thought he was a quack. My mother said he's a genius. So that's why I went there. I wanted to be an investigative journalist, and I wanted to make the decision. Is he a quack or is he a genius? And then when he met me at the station and he says, "Your fast has begun," I thought, this guy is a total quack. He's a lunatic. I got to get out of here. And so I thought, my father was right. He is a nutcase. And then by the end, I thought, he's the smartest person I've ever met in my life. He's a complete genius. All these hopeless cases, terminal cancer, he heals them. And they're done. And I come from a long lineage of doctors. And he said that his father, my grandfather, was a doctor too. He said, but those patients kept coming back because they never got really healed. And his patients don't come back unless they just want to, you know, want to go through that again, but they're not terminal anymore. One of the patients said, you know, I hope you become a doctor and come work with your uncle. And I remember saying to her, no, I can't be a doctor. I'm not a genius, because I was comparing myself with him. So I went for 10 years with this misconception that I wasn't good enough to be a doctor. I wasn't brilliant enough. But I am really glad I had that misperception, because otherwise I wouldn't have had those 10 years, and I would go as an immature medical student who knew nothing about life, and especially not the things you see in medicine, you know, life and death and so forth. So I am so grateful that I had these 10 years, even though it was all a misperception. I thought my purpose in life was to work for Outward Bound and form my own experiential outdoor education school, because what happened with Outward Bound was so meaningful. All that the transformation those students made. I had two gang members on my course, and I had an MIT professor who'd never carried a pack or walked in the wilderness. And I put one of the gang members with the professor together. And at first it was really rocky. I thought, oh my God, this is going to be a scary course. And it was life-changing for both of them. And that gang member, he discovered when he helped this older man, he was 61, MIT professor, didn't know anything about wilderness and never carried a backpack. And so Jackson, the gang member, was always helping him cross rivers and help carry his pack and stuff. And he said around the campfire one time, "Hey man, this feels really good." he felt important in a good way. And people regarded him as a hero. I mean, he'd help people in distress and stuff, and it changed his whole life. He said he was going to write a letter to the judge at first, his first step, and thank the judge for not sending him to jail, but instead sending him to my course. The first day on my course, he said, I should have gone to jail because it was so hard. So then I decided I was going to get my master's degree, and the studies were so easy. I didn't have to really do much. So I decided I was going to take some of the courses that I missed out in college, because I tested out of them. So I signed up at University of Colorado for advanced placement biology and chemistry. And of course, I was the oldest person in the class. They were all like very young. And I discovered that they all were pre-med students, and I was the only one who wasn't pre-med. And that's when I had an awakening. That's another miracle that I took those courses, because I discovered, oh my God, these guys aren't even that smart. And they're going to be our future doctors. Oh my God. I can do this. It's about memorizing. There's no critical thinking. There's no saying, well, how do you know that? And why doesn't that do that? And no questioning. It was all about memorizing and doing great on standardized tests. I said, oh my God, I can do that. That's easy. I can memorize. I'm a good memorizer. And when I was in England in the first grade, I memorized a whole poem and I didn't even know what it meant. I didn't even know what the words meant, but I memorized it. I was good at that. I thought, oh my God, I've gone 10 years and it was right in front of me the whole time. Then I was told I was too old to go to med school.
Oh, I know. And that part of the book was so frustrating to read and so annoying, you know, from this perspective, right? From where we are in this time, so frustrating and annoying to read that this person says, oh, no. Almost like he patted you on the head. And he's like, no. Nice little pipe dream there, but that's not going to happen. And you just, it gets your head up and you're just like, oh yeah, I'm going to show you. And then you have, I mean, you meet, I love that you talk to the Stanford guy, the guy who accepts people into Stanford. And you said, I mean, I was reading your book and you're like, hey, why don't you come to Denver to see if I'm a good fit for your med school? And I thought, what? Who does that? I mean, what? Wait a second. And then you talk to someone and they said, oh my God, he's never going to come. Nobody ever does that. And you say, no, I'm going to teach you cross country skiing. And the guy from Stanford comes to Colorado.
I told him I was in the Peace Corps and made $120 a month. This is on the phone, the admissions count. And this is after the counselor, college counselor, told me to forget it. You know, nobody would ever accept me. And so I applied to three places, and Stanford was one of them. Against all odds, I get a call from admissions, and they say, we'd like to interview you. We'd like you to fly out on such and such date. And I didn't know the rules of behavior. Thank God. Sometimes it's good you don't know the rules, because then you wouldn't get anything done. And so and I'm very truthful. I'm not full of artifice. I'm very transparent. So I said, you know, I can't afford it. I don't have any savings. And, you know, it would be very costly because I'd have to, you know, buy some nice outfit and then stay at a hotel and plane fare and everything. Do you think you could come out here and interview me? And then there was no answer. And that's when I talked really fast. I said, I realized, I think I said something wrong. And so I talked really fast, said, well, you know, if you came out here, you know, I'm a former Outward Bound instructor and I have all this gear and I could teach you how to cross country ski. And I would provide everything, the lunch and the backpacks and the gear, and we could go to Rocky Mountain National Park and ski in there and then have our lunch on a log and with the sun shining down while you interview me, and then silence. And then he says, I'll get back with you. And then my classmates got so upset with me. They said, why don't you follow the rules? He's never going to call you back. You blew it. You blew it. Why? You can just borrow money, get out a loan, and buy some nice clothes and pay for the airfare in your hotel, for God's sakes. Well, he did call me back. And he said, he asked his supervisor, he told what happened. And this, they read all my information and they decided they wanted 1% I can't remember, 10% of their student population to be very different and out of the box, because it's like breeding. You breed another thing and you get a new thing. And so so he came out and he said it's the best interview he'd ever had.
I love that, because I do think that just, you know, you've lived an unconventional life. Let's say that, you know, first of all, I've read your first and second book, as I said, and I don't even know how many languages you speak, but when I was reading the second book and you're like, and then I learned Navajo and I thought, what, how could she ever think she wasn't a genius or at least insanely intelligent? Because no one just says, oh, by the way, hey, I learned Navajo, because it is a insanely challenging language that is beyond most of us, but you learned it and your life has been so out of the box, so exceptional and so different. You've had this really gorgeous life of your own making, but it's all led you to this place where you can take all your teachings, all your experiences. And I do have to say, reading the book, one of the things that was most powerful for me was the friendship between Jackson and Jerome on that outward bound trip, and how afterwards Jerome was like, I'm going to support you, Jackson. I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you with graduating high school and going to college. And I thought, you know, that in itself was a miracle for me. Listening to that
when
story.
When I give a reading of that, I start to cry, because when I give readings, I relive what I'm talking. I'm right there. And so I had to wipe away the tears talking about Jerome and Jackson. I mean, it was so powerful.
Yeah. And a miracle. And, you know, we have like 15 minutes left. I'd love to hear any other stories of magic or miracles that you'd like to share.
Do you want to hear one from the first book?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So once I started learning even just a few sentences in Navajo in the very beginning, I couldn't really have a conversation. I'm just saying, hello, where do you live? How many sheep do you have? And so forth. And what's your name? And I couldn't really say much in the beginning because it's so hard. But they warmed up to me so fast once I even just trying touched them. And because nobody tried, no white person really tried except the trading post people. So there were several families that kind of, quote, adopted me, took me in, and not physically, but just invited me to their ceremonies a lot and stuff. And there's one family that was belonged to Native American church. That's the Peyote. And it was illegal for white people to do that. But they invited me to my first peyote ceremony when I hadn't been there very long. And they told me how to dress. I had to dress completely traditional with the velvet top and the satin skirt and the woven band and the concha belt and all the squash blossom necklace and the turquoise. And I mean, I look like I was ready for Navajo prom. I looked really, and I had that tie in the back where it's called siyesh, and they tie it with yarn. And I looked in the mirror, I couldn't get over it. And so anyway, my Navajo mother, she told me to call her Shima, means mom. So Shima said she was going to sit next to me and she whispered to me what to do and stuff. She had explained how the whole thing works and everything. And there's a roadman. It's like a medicine man, but it's called roadman, that sits facing the east where the door is. And then we're in a circle in a teepee. Why in a teepee? Navajos don't live in teepees. They live in hogans. It's because the peyote ceremony was borrowed from the Plains Indians they used peyote ceremonies during a time of horrible hardship where many of them were murdered by white people and just decimated. So out of desperation, they started doing these peyote ceremonies in their teepees. And so that's why in the summer they use teepees, the Navajos, and hogans is where they really live, in hogans. So we were all in a circle, and there's several stages of what happens. The ceremony was for a sick baby, and also for the war in Vietnam, and because so many Native people were dying in Vietnam. And so what I was focused on during the ceremony is that the baby started looking better and better and better. And I mean, the redness left the face and was making eye contact with the mom, was not fussy, was peaceful. I was so focused on that. And anyway, so first of all, the sacred tobacco, they used to climb up the San Francisco peaks. Now it's a ski area, sadly, but they used to get these special healing herbs, and we would smoke the sacred tobacco, and it'd go around, and you'd say a prayer. And when it was after my Shima, my Navajo mother, did her prayer, she handed it to me, and she whispered, "Just pass it on." And I didn't do that. I don't know what possessed me. So I inhale, and then I said a prayer in Navajo. I mean, I didn't speak Navajo then. And a prayer? How would I learn a prayer? Where did I learn that from? And so while this was happening, I had two voices inside of me. One voice said, "This isn't real. This, you're hallucinating. This is part of the peyote. It makes you think this is happening. It's not really happening. It's not happening." And the other voice said, "Yes, it is happening. This is real. This is more real than real life." And then I passed it on, and everybody was staring at me. And then they have the water drum, and you hit the drum, and it makes a very ethereal sound because it's water in there in a metal container with a hide stretched over it. And you sing, like, "Hey, nay, young, ayo." And again, it came to the mother, and she sang a song. And then she said, "Pass it on." And I didn't pass it on. And I sang a song that I'd never heard before in Navajo. And again, those voices said, no, that you're just making this up. This isn't really happening. Yes, it is happening. And so then it went on all night. And then by morning, the peyote had started to wear off. And we all filed out. And then we kneeled down to put our forehead on the ground and bless ourselves with the eagle feather fan. And then went into the adjacent block home that they had. And some of the women had been up all night making a beautiful breakfast. We sat on the floor with a sheet, and it was mutton stew and fry bread and peaches for dessert. And the roadman was sitting at the end, and then we were all eating there on the floor. And he started talking to me in Navajo. And I felt so uncomfortable because I didn't know what he was saying. The peyote had worn off. Just felt so uncomfortable. I said, "Yeah, you know, I don't really understand what you're saying." And everybody burst out laughing. And he said, "You really talked up a storm last night." I said, "You mean it really happened?" He said, "You bet. You betcha." And oh my God, it did not fit my logical mind. So for years, I never told anybody about it because I thought they think I made it up. They think I was crazy because this can't happen. But okay, so here's what happened. At one of the readings I gave, that's 5 years ago, the bookstore, local bookstore, Garcia Street, was jam-packed, 100 people jam-packed in this small place. And because I'm known here, I'm the doctor to so many people here. That's why. And so I told that story. And somebody said, "How do you explain that?" And I said, I can't explain it. And I said, it took me years to have the nerve to even tell the story. And a guy stood up and he said, "I'm a quantum physicist and I can explain very easily what happened to you." He said, "All knowledge, past, present, and future is out there. And he said, "We have no access to it because when we were babies, there was a lot of pruning done for different neurological pathways in order that we wouldn't go crazy knowing everything. So our brain created a small box to work in that was manageable, but with no access to everything out there. And with the peyote, it gave you a window of everything out there. So you could access the Navajo language. And when the peyote wore off, the door closed. And I said, you know, that sounds believable. And it's nice it's coming from you and not from me. That's the story.
That's an utterly amazing story. And I just would have loved to have been a little fly on the wall with your whole experience during that time, because you really had some powerful experiences. And on the first time I had you on the show, you talked about the werewolf story, which was just completely unbelievable. And you kind of alluded to this story. So I'm glad that you told this story and fleshed it out a little bit. And what's even more astonishing, well, it sounds like the peyote kind of opened you up.
Yes, it allowed me to learn Navajo, because nobody could learn that fast. And so I think that experience and then how they explained what happened to me, they had their own explanation. They said it's because my heart is Navajo. That's what they said. My heart is Navajo. They said in another life, you were a Navajo woman.
That makes sense. I mean, yeah, as I said, I was kind of agog when you said I learned how to speak Navajo. And I thought, what? Because on Duolingo, I think it's Duolingo, the language app, I think they have Navajo up there. Yeah. And so I started trying to learn it. And I thought, what am I, crazy pants? I can't do this.
Did you want me to say a few words in Navajo?
Oh, I would love that.
Okay. Nisha Chatena Na Chashinye. I said, where are you from and what's your name? So she Erica Elliot Yinishye. Onch in addition in Ashlad Nesna deemed Oba de Bashla is it Ado Begashi. Onch indi Rodanda. They're sounds that don't exist in English.
No, absolutely. That's what I was thinking. It's very, it's interesting looking at your mouth and how you're placing your tongue to pronounce some of those sounds. But it's also, it sounds really beautiful. It sounds very, I don't know, sometimes I think of language as musical. It sounds like it has the potential to be musical.
Yeah. Would you like me to sing you a very, very short healing medicine man song?
For listening to this episode of the Bite Sized Blessings podcast. And I'd like to thank my returning guest, the absolutely unflappable Dr. Erica Elliott, for agreeing to come back to the show and tell more of her fabulous stories. Please do pick up her book, From Mountains to Medicine. Now, I do want to let you know there will be a link to buy her book in the episode show notes, as well as a link to Dr. Erica Elliott's website. So to find out more about this incredible human being, please do click on that and do a deeper dive into just who this woman is. Thank you to everyone who listens to this podcast. And as well, thanks to those of you who have left a rating or written a little review. If you haven't yet done so, please go to either Apple or Spotify and give me I don't know, 5 stars because you like what you're hearing. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find us. And don't forget about the YouTube channel. That's another little gem. You'll actually be able to see Dr. Erica in real life on the Bite Size Blessings YouTube channel. And there will be a link for that as well. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Dr. Erica. Be unstoppable. I mean, come on. This woman just kind of sets her mind to something and then goes and does it. And I don't know if you remember, but the first time I interviewed her, she talked about the head injury she sustained during her life and how that hasn't even stopped her. I mean, this is one formidable human being we're talking about. So be like Dr. Erica. See mountains that you must climb, dream of adventures that you absolutely are going to go on, and then think of your life and imagine what you will into existence. The only one who's holding you back is you. So whatever you dream, whatever you envision, whatever you imagine in the adventure that is your life, be like Dr. Erica and then go out. Go out and take a great big bite out of life and have adventures from dawn until dusk.